1-877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO to get started.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
This is Donna Walker, host of Pacifica Performance Showcase here on KPFK. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
Thursday, July 2nd, I'm Scott Baba. The United Nations announces work has begun on two possible treatments for the ongoing Ebola outbreak causing sickness and social unrest in eastern Congo.
An Ebola treatment center in Ituri province was attacked, resulting in the deaths of two people, and the center was set on fire and patients fled. Such acts not only endanger patients and health workers, but also impaired efforts to stop transmission and save lives.
California Governor Gavin Newsom signs this year's state budget.
I just signed my final budget as governor of California, on time, balanced, and structurally sound.
And we take a look at one of the largest gatherings in the world dedicated entirely to artificial intelligence.
I think this is the first time in human history where we are actually scaling intelligence, which creates a very different disruption in every industries. If we are getting closer to the base level of human intelligence and we can scale it out, then eventually I think every single job is impacted.
These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. Iran is threatening a, quote, forceful response against any oil tanker that strays from its approved routes through the Strait of Hormuz. The AP's Karen Chamis reports.
Iran's Joint Military Command warned on Thursday that all oil tankers moving through the Strait of Hormuz must use its approved routes or face what it called a forceful response. The statement from the Khatam al-Anbiya Military Command was reported by Iranian state television. It comes after both U.S. and Iranian diplomats met with mediators on Wednesday in Qatar. The warning has ratcheted up tensions over a waterway crucial for international energy supplies. The strait has emerged as one of the top issues in negotiations to reach a permanent end to the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. I'm Karen Chamas.
Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump has sought to portray the reopening of the strait in a positive light, saying yesterday,
as far as things are going, the denuclearization of Iran is moving along well. They've had very good meetings, and we'll see. We hit them very hard for three nights, as you know, but we're getting along very well. So I call it the denuclearization, and it's all taking place. It's all going well.
But experts say Tehran understands the strategic value of controlling access to the strait and how much President Trump sees its reopening as vital to his political future. Karen Fisher has more.
He knows that domestically, the cost of Filling up your car at the gas station is really important to American voters, and he knows he needs to keep those fuel prices low, especially ahead of the midterm elections coming up in November. So keeping free transit through the strait is vital for the US president, and the Iranians know that, of course, and that is why they know they can use this as leverage to try to put pressure on the Americans at the negotiating table.
Kate Fisher, Washington.
The Gaza war reached its 1,000th day today, with both sides exhausted and a fragile ceasefire still leaving civilians at risk. Gaza's health ministry said more than 1,000 Palestinians have died since the ceasefire took effect last October, despite reduced Israeli strikes. Israeli forces control much of the territory and say they aim to expand further. The October 2023 Hamas-led attack killed about 1,200 people and took 251 hostages. All hostages or their remains have since been returned. Hamas's disarmament remains the key sticking point, stalling next steps in the U.S.-brokered peace deal overseen by President Trump's Board of Peace. In Israel, more than 60% of people polled say Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should not seek re-election this fall, amid anger over security failures before October 7th. In Gaza, humanitarian aid remains limited, with border crossings tightly restricted and reconstruction stalled. A bomb ripped through a crowded cafe near Damascus's main courthouse today, killing at least 9 people and wounding 20 others. Jennifer King reports.
In the capital of Syria, blood and shattered glass littered the floor of a cafe where an explosive device detonated, killing at least 9 people and injuring 20 others. Investigators are at the scene. The cafe in downtown Damascus is located near the Palace of Justice. Jalal Al-Janani owns a restaurant next door. We found victims and bodies laying on the ground, he says. We carried the victims to the cars until the police arrived. Damascus Governor Maher Marwan Idlibi said the device appeared primitive and vowed that the perpetrators would be held to account. Syria's new leaders have cracked down on Islamic State militants, but continue to contend with security concerns and a military incursion by Israel since the overthrow of the Assad regime in December of 2024. I'm Jennifer King.
The head of the United Nations World Health Organization today announced that researchers have begun a highly anticipated study of 2 possible treatments for the Ebola outbreak in eastern Congo. The World Health Organization's Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said today the first participant has been enrolled in a trial that could take months to tell if either drug helps improve survival. Max Pringle reports.
The virus causing the Ebola outbreak is less common than others that cause Ebola disease, and there are no current specific treatments or vaccines for it. The study will test if drugs called remdesivir and MBP-134, given alone or in combination, help more than today's standard supportive care. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said trials are underway.
The partners trial will evaluate the monoclonal antibody MBP-134 and the antiviral drug remdesivir alone and in combination. The study is being coordinated by DRC's National Institute for Biomedical Research, supported by a coalition of partners, including WHO, and conducted in close cooperation with the affected communities.
The WHO said already more than 1,400 people have been diagnosed with Ebola and 438 have died. It's spread through direct contact with body fluids of infected people or animals or contaminated objects. It isn't airborne like flu or COVID. Dr. Ghebreyesus said the WHO has given authorization for the first Ebola trial test to screen for the disease.
WHO has given emergency use listing to the first molecular diagnostic test for Bundibugyo virus.
He said distrust, fear, and violence have taken hold in some of the affected areas, which is hampering efforts to deal with the Ebola outbreak.
Just this week, an Ebola treatment center in Ituri province was attacked, resulting in the deaths of 2 people, and the center was set on fire and patients fled. Such acts not only endanger patients and health workers, but also impede efforts to stop transmission and save lives. The complexity of the outbreak requires close coordination across the United Nations system.
Ghebreyesus said international cooperation is critical in fighting infectious disease, and efforts are underway to set up an international network to coordinate across borders.
Next week, WHO member states will reconvene to continue negotiations on the pathogen access and benefit sharing system of the WHO pandemic agreement. Differences remain, but one thing is clear. Countries remain committed to finding common ground and consensus.
During his address, Ghebreyesus also declared that the hantavirus outbreak that began last April on a cruise ship in the Atlantic has officially ended. That outbreak killed 3 people and sickened 13 others. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
At least 21 people are dead after Russia's largest overnight assault on Kyiv in more than 4 years of war. Officials say Russia launched nearly 500 drones and more than 70 missiles at the capital, tearing open a 9-story apartment building and sparking fires across the city. About 70 people were hospitalized, and the death toll is expected to rise as rescuers search the rubble. More than 50,000 residents sheltered in metro stations overnight after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned an attack was likely. Zelensky cut short a trip to Ireland to visit the strike site, saying the damage would have been less severe if allies had delivered promised air defense systems. In his regular evening address following the attacks, Zelensky called on allies to step up anti-ballistic missile support and urged the United States in particular to grant Ukraine licenses for Patriot missile production. He said, unfortunately, there is a shortage of anti-ballistic capabilities, a shortage of patriots, and our partners, primarily the United States and our European partners, need to be more proactive in providing assistance in this regard. Russia has no argument left for its war other than its ballistic missiles. This kind of terror, Putin still intends to vanquish residential buildings rather than end this war, and this can be countered both through sufficient supplies of anti-ballistic systems and through much faster work to develop Europe's own anti-ballistic capabilities. Poland scrambled fighter jets as a precaution during the massive attack. Russia claims the strikes were retaliation for Ukraine's attacks on its territory and insisted the strikes targeted military-linked sites. Dasha Chernichova reports.
The Russian officials insist that this is the retaliation against Ukrainian military for their actions that Moscow labels as terrorism on the Russian territory. The Kremlin also saying that Russia is going to continue to step up pressure on Ukraine because they are seeing the increased Ukrainian attacks on the Russian territory.
And that was Dasha Chernichova reporting. Diplomatic efforts to end the conflict remain stalled. Kyiv Mayor Vitaly Klitschko has declared Friday a day of mourning. Meanwhile, a new study estimates Russia's war in Ukraine has now caused more than 2 million total casualties, making it one of the most deadliest conflicts in modern history. The Center for Strategic and International Studies said Russia has suffered roughly 1.4 million casualties, including about 450,000 deaths. That's about 1% of its entire population. Ukraine's casualties are estimated between 525 and 625,000, including up to 150,000 fatalities. Study authors Seth Jones and Riley McCabe say Russian deaths already exceed all U.S. combat deaths since World War II combined, 4 times over. The casualty ratio has widened to nearly 8 Russian losses for every Ukrainian one this year. Researchers say, crediting Ukraine's expanded drone kill zones along the front. Neither country releases official casualty figures, but the estimates align with other Western assessments. ICE arrested more than 10,000 immigrants over a 5-day period this week, roughly doubling its previous daily pace. This, according to reporting by the New York Times. Internal documents show agency leaders ordered officers to ramp up arrests after pressure from the White House, setting a new goal of 2,000 arrests per day. Arrests peaked Saturday at over 2,400, pushing ICE's detained population past 63,000. Unlike last year's high-profile city sweeps, this surge unfolded quietly without advance warnings. Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen had pledged a lower-profile approach following a chaotic Minnesota operation in which federal officers killed two U.S. citizens. Immigration attorneys reported arrests at check-ins, traffic stops, and routine court appearances nationwide, including a Nigerian nun in Texas and a Utah father detained on his way to a soccer game. Utah immigration attorney Isabel Lenozco said the uptick has been significant and the community has noticed, saying, quote, they are just terrified with these detentions. The Department of Justice is suing Massachusetts to block undocumented students from accessing in-state tuition rates at public colleges and universities. Catherine Carley reports.
The lawsuit targets the state's tuition equity law, which ensures immigrants, regardless of their legal status, pay the same tuition as other residents and can access financial aid. Sarang Sekavat with the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition says the law has had a positive impact on both immigrant youth and the state as a whole.
We're increasing our knowledge base in the state. We're improving our labor force. We're increasing our tax base by doing things like this.
The DOJ argues the law unconstitutionally discriminates against U.S. citizens and creates incentives for illegal immigration. Sekavat says the law was created to ensure equal treatment for all students, including those who've grown up in Massachusetts but didn't have the same opportunities as their peers. The DOJ has filed similar lawsuits over in-state tuition programs in at least a dozen other states, including Rhode Island earlier this week. Officials in Kentucky, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas agreed to end their policies. A federal judge dismissed a lawsuit in Minnesota, arguing federal immigration law does not preempt the state's statute, but the DOJ has filed an appeal. Sekavat says he's confident in Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell's ability to defend the state's education standard.
For the students who are out there who are nervous about this, we do have the law on our side. Be patient. This is going to take a while to play out, but we do think eventually we'll get a positive result out of this.
More than 12,000 undocumented students are currently enrolled in Massachusetts public colleges and universities, according to the Higher Ed Immigration Portal. An estimated 1,000 undocumented students graduate in the state each year. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The United States is rapidly building what it calls a smart wall on the Mexico border, combining tall steel fencing with advanced technology like sensors and cameras. Critics argue this militarizes the border and impacts local communities. Customs and Border Protection said the technology helps free up agents for other tasks. Contracts for hundreds of miles of wall have been signed. The wall has been a top priority for Republican President Donald Trump, with $46 billion allocated for its completion. Critics warn of privacy concerns and environmental impacts. The project continues to face scrutiny over costs and oversight. Advocates for refugees say the Supreme Court's narrow decision to uphold birthright citizenship is a win, but they argue it does not change the legal barriers children born to immigrants face when trying to access equal rights. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Zane Lacani with the Women's Refugee Commission says citizenship is supposed to be universal, but it's not applied that way in the U.S. She cites regulations limiting access to public housing and other benefits for mixed-status families, and she points to the federal child tax credit, with Republicans last year pushing through changes that blocked eligibility for these households.
So this is a way in which you do not get those vital, life-sustaining benefits to which you are entitled to as a U.S. citizen because one of your parents is an immigrant.
In restricting access to the CTC, Republican lawmakers argued it was needed to stop incentivizing illegal immigration. There are about 6 million people born in the U.S. who live in a mixed-status household, according to the American Immigration Council. Zane says they are not experiencing equal citizenship rights in the same way as their peers who have U.S. citizen parents. Zane notes current immigration enforcement practices also hinder access to citizenship rights. She says parents are being deported without opportunities to arrange legal caretakers for their children, despite U.S. policy requiring it. This leaves U.S. citizen children in the care of people who aren't able to line up essential services, enroll the kids in school, obtain health care, or secure passports for family reunification.
These children, they have legal rights as citizens to all of these benefits, but they are not able to access them because their parent was deported without being able to assign them a legal guardian.
In Wisconsin, where an estimated 28,000 families are mixed status, leaders remain split on this week's Supreme Court rulings. Attorney General Josh Call says the fact that the high court is debating birthright citizenship and several justices dissented is concerning. Meanwhile, Congressman Derek Van Orden believes the court's ruling risks further incentivizing abuse of the immigration system. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
The U.S. labor force participation rate has fallen to its lowest level in 50 years outside the pandemic era as hundreds of thousands of Americans give up looking for work. The Labor Department reports the rate dropped to 61.5% in June, down from 61.8% in May. That's the lowest since March of 2021. The labor force shrank by 720,000 people last month alone, while those counted as not in the labor force jumped by 832,000. That exodus helped push the unemployment rate down to 4.2% from 4.3%, but for the wrong reasons, since people who stopped searching are no longer counted as unemployed. Meanwhile, employers added just 57,000 jobs in June, less than half of May's total, signaling a continued caution from businesses. Restaurants, bars, and hotels cut 61,000 jobs despite the World Cup drawing crowds to U.S. cities. Average wages rose only 3.5% from a year ago, still trailing inflation. Economists say the participation drop isn't just retiring baby boomers. Participation among prime-age workers, 25 to 54, also fell sharply last month, hitting its lowest point since December of 2023. Navy Federal Credit Union economist Heather Long said it was, quote, shocking to see 720,000 people stop looking for work entirely. President Donald Trump has begun explicitly tying disaster aid announcements to campaign endorsements, dropping earlier hints for overt political messaging. In a series of social media posts this week, Trump paired approvals of federal disaster relief for Florida, Kansas, Michigan, Louisiana, Wisconsin, and Idaho with praise for Republican candidates he's endorsed, including Kansas Senate hopeful Ty Masterson and Michigan Senate candidate Mike Rogers. The practice follows a Politico analysis earlier this year that found Trump has rejected disaster aid for Democratic-run states at the highest rate in FEMA's 47-year history, while approvals for Republican-led states have risen. Last month, Democratic Senator Gary Peters of Michigan questioned the discrepancy in a hearing with Secretary of Homeland Security Mark Wayne Mullen.
Under Trump's second tenure as president, we have witnessed the politicization of disaster assistance. Unfortunately, I think it's a massive scale. There are reports that President Trump has approved nearly 90% of disaster requests from red states, but only 23% from blue states, even when the request met the FEMA established threshold for federal assistance. I have behind me a chart that's up there now showing this unprecedented politicization of disaster assistance by the administration. I don't think there's any other president since the establishment of FEMA that has chosen to actually punish American citizens that have survived a flood or a wildfire because of their home state governor or senator's political affiliation.
President Trump's newly released financial disclosure shows he purchased roughly $500,000 in Abbott Laboratory stock last year, shortly before his Justice Department dropped a years-long criminal investigation into the company. The Wall Street Journal reports prosecutors had considered charging Abbott over contamination found near infant formula equipment in its Michigan plant, linked to at least 9 infant deaths. Abbott had donated $500,000 to Trump's inaugural fund. Separately, the disclosure also reveals Trump made 327 stock purchases worth up to $12.8 million on April 8th of 2025, the day before he paused sweeping tariffs, triggering one of the S&P 500's largest single-day gains ever. Federal law requires officials to disclose stock trades within 45 days. Trump disclosed the trades more than a year later. The White House has not responded to the disclosure's findings. Ethics watchdogs call the pattern a serious conflict of interest. A former Olympic canoe racer has been indicted on a felony charge accused of vandalizing the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool during its now $16 million renovation. Sagar Magani reports.
The Trump administration has indicted a former U.S. Olympian in what President Trump has called vandalism at the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool. David Hearn is facing a felony charge of property destruction, with U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro here in Washington saying National Park Service employees saw Hearn reach in and deliberately damage the pool.
Forcefully and violently pulling up and removing the bottom liner with both hands.
Hearn told the AP he reached in to examine the coating that had started peeling after the president's $14 million plus renovation project. Hearn said he briefly touched a chunk still attached to the pool, but let go after a park worker told him to. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Speaking on MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes, Hearn said he was surprised by the response from federal agents.
I didn't think I'd done anything wrong, so I had no reason to think I was going to be arrested, but I suggested we walk over toward the park police rather than waiting for them to come to us, and went over and furnished my ID, and kind of before I knew it, I was being handcuffed and realized I was being arrested.
Democratic Colorado Governor Jared Polis has fired two members of his clemency advisory board after they publicly criticized his decision to free Tina Peters. Polis removed attorneys Hannah Siegel Prof and Azra Taslimi, saying they breached confidentiality by revealing board votes, according to letters first reported by the New York Times. Peters, the former Mesa County clerk, was convicted of election-related crimes after giving an associate of Mike Lindell access to voting systems. Polis commuted her 9-year sentence in May, drawing sharp criticism from fellow Democrats. Siegel Prof and Taslimi wrote that the board had twice unanimously recommended denying Peters' clemency. Polis spokesperson Eric Maruyama says confidentiality is essential to the clemency process. Two new members have been appointed to the board. Peters met with President Donald Trump at the White House this week, where he claimed she caught Democrats cheating. Prosecutors say a skyscraper-scaling daredevil told police that he and his girlfriend climbed the Empire State Building's antenna yesterday because he wanted to, quote, do something special for their engagement. Ed Donahue reports.
A couple is being charged with felonies in New York after climbing the antenna on the 102-story Empire State Building.
Anything you want to say?
A couple who go by Angela Nicolau and Ivan Birkus said little as they left court. Birkus responded to one question about the stunt by saying, "We believe in love." Prosecutors say the two climbed to the top and unfurled a banner about love and peace because he wanted to do something special for their engagement. They were arraigned on felony reckless endangerment, burglary, and other charges. The couple was the subject of a 2024 Netflix documentary, Skywalkers, A Love Story, about their rooftopping exploits and budding romance. I'm Ed Donahue.
Rescuers have pulled a 43-year-old security guard alive from a collapsed basement, ending a grueling days-long operation that became a symbol of hope after the devastation of twin earthquakes that struck Venezuela 8 days earlier. Hernan Alberto Gil Flores was extracted safely after being trapped since June 24th under the rubble in the basement of the Galerias Playa Grande shopping center in the coastal town of La Guaira. Rescuers initially made contact with him over the weekend. Gil Flores, who worked as a night shift security guard at the complex, was inside his small security cabin when the first violent tremor struck. A new study finds no link between Tylenol use during pregnancy and autism, contradicting claims made by President Trump and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The study, published in JAMA International Medicine, analyzed health records for more than 700,000 mother-child pairs in Hong Kong, using a sibling-matched design to account for genetic and family factors. Researchers found no connection between prenatal acetaminophen use and autism or ADHD, regardless of dosage or timing during pregnancy. Trump and Kennedy warned pregnant women against the drug last year without clear evidence, urging them to, quote, tough it out instead. Medical groups pushed back, noting untreated fever during pregnancy carries its own risks. Similar sibling match studies in Sweden and Japan reached the same conclusion. Researchers say earlier studies suggesting a link likely reflected other family-related factors and not the drug itself. International Park Service documents show this year's July 4th fireworks show in Washington, D.C. is expected to cause hazardous air pollution around the National Mall. The Washington Post reports the show will include roughly 850,000 fireworks over about 40 minutes, billed as the largest pyrotechnic display in history to mark the 250th anniversary of U.S. independence. President Trump is set to speak. Draft modeling predicts very unhealthy conditions across central D.C., including downtown Arlington and Capitol Hill, with elevated pollution lasting 3 to 6 hours after the show. Experts say the fine particulate released can irritate lungs and trigger asthma attacks. The Park Service is advising people to stay indoors during and after the show. The Interior Department did not respond to questions from the Washington Post. You're listening to the Pacific Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. We'll be back with more after this.
There are many ways to support the programs that you love on KPFK. Becoming a member, starting a monthly gift, donating a vehicle that you don't need anymore. And now, donating a piece of land or other real estate. More about the advantages of donating real estate is at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed his final state budget as governor, a $351.7 billion plan that raises some business and health care taxes while pushing the state's reserves to nearly $29 billion.
I just signed my final budget as governor of California, on time, balanced, and structurally sound. Not just this year, but through June of 2028. For the next 2 years, California will have a $0 deficit. We're leaving the state in good hands for the next governor.
Among other things, the deal softens deep Medi-Cal cuts Newsom had proposed earlier this year. It delays the shift of roughly 2 million immigrant enrollees, most undocumented, to a fee-for-service system until January of 2027, preserving benefits like case management and housing assistance for now. Coverage limits for about 150,000 refugees and asylum seekers are also pushed back a year. The budget preserves the in-home supportive services program for about 900,000 low-income Californians and sets a less restrictive asset test for Medi-Cal eligibility among seniors and people with disabilities than Newsom initially wanted. To help pay for it, the state reworked a tax on health providers to comply with new federal rules under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. That requires California to also raise taxes on private health plans, which the insurance industry warns could push up premiums. On education, the budget increases special education funding by $2.4 billion and adds nearly 23,000 child care slots after lawmakers rejected Newsom's proposed cuts. It also withholds $3.9 billion in K-12 funding that's guaranteed by the 1988 Prop 98 as a budget cushion. David Goldberg, president of the California Teachers Association, said the move is short-sighted and that his group may challenge it in court.
The main thing we always have to remember is that California is the fourth largest economy in the world, not the fourth largest state economy, but if we were our own nation, we would be the fourth largest economy. So withholding constitutionally guaranteed money for public education, or frankly, money from any social services, is unacceptable. And it's just another case of really balancing the budgets on the backs of working people, on students, on families and educators. And it's something that our union and educators across the state are going to continue to always stand up and always try to fight.
The budget also quietly eliminated $5.5 million in funding for Compass, an online research database used by California's 10,000 public schools, effective July of 2027. State librarians say they had no advance notice of the cut, which strips students of free access to resources like Encyclopedia Britannica, The New York Times, PBS videos, and scientific journals. Individual schools would pay more than $216 million annually to replace those materials on their own, a cost lower-income districts are unlikely to absorb. Newsom's office said recent K-12 funding increases should cover the gap, but librarians call the loss catastrophic, warning it will deepen disparities between wealthier and poorer schools. Newsom also won a restructuring of California's elected school chief position, shifting most authority away from the elected California State Superintendent of Public Instruction to a new education commissioner appointed by the governor, a change some educators and Democratic senators criticized as undemocratic. Goldberg noted that California voters had just voted for a new superintendent in last month's primary.
To kind of unilaterally in Sacramento, along with unfortunately a complicit legislature, remove the ability of parents and students and community members to elect the superintendent of public instruction is completely undemocratic. Four times in the history of our state, they've tried to remove this position and make it a non-elected position, and each time the voters of California have said no. So doing this now makes no sense. And it takes away the voices of people closest to education, including students and families and educators.
Meanwhile, counties will get $900 million for homelessness programs, nearly double what Newsom proposed, and $200 million to verify eligibility for health and food benefits under new federal requirements. Newsom credited an unexpected tax windfall tied partly to the AI sector's stock market gains with helping to close the deficit without broad new taxes. He argued that the budget he'd signed was a victory for the state's fundamental principles.
For 40 years in this country, we've been told that government can't deliver, that public investments don't work, that progressive ideas never pencil out. Well, California, with all due respect, is proof that all that's wrong. We did it here, and we can do it everywhere. We did the math. We did the work. We did the big things. And so to every other state across our country, to Washington, D.C., to anyone who's been told that responsibility and ambition, they can't share the same balance sheet, come to California. Look at the numbers.
Republicans, however, criticized the process and the state's long-term outlook. Speaking ahead of the budget vote last month, Republican State Assembly member David Tangipa said the proposed budget was full of Democratic priorities that would raise costs and taxes for state residents.
This budget is a clear reflection of the majority's values. If you're a hardworking Californian or a small business owner, your taxes are going up. If you pay for private health insurance, your premiums are going up. If you run a business and use QuickBooks, Microsoft 365, Adobe, or any digital tools, your costs are going up. If you're an employer, your payroll taxes are going up.
The nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office confirms the budget still leaves a projected $8 billion structural deficit ahead, although that's down from as much as $30 billion. Voters will also decide in November whether to expand the state's rainy day fund to help future governors avoid deep cuts during lean years. A federal judge has struck down the Trump administration's 2025 attempt to shift homelessness funding away from permanent housing and towards temporary shelters. U.S. District Judge Mary McElroy ruled the Department of Housing and Urban Development failed to consider the harm its rushed policy change would cause, calling it the, quote, hallmark of unreasoned decision-making. The rule would have capped permanent housing spending at 30% of roughly $4 billion in federal funds. California communities had spent about 90% of their share on permanent housing last year. California and other states sued, along with San Francisco, Santa Clara County, and a number of national homelessness groups. Renee Willis of the National Low Income Housing Coalition praised the ruling, saying, quote, the federal court's decision to reject the Trump-Vance administration's attempt to disrupt essential housing services for people experiencing homelessness, including families, seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities, is both appropriate and just. The ruling does not block future changes. The administration has already proposed similar cuts for 2026 funding. House Republicans blocked Representative Jared Huffman's latest attempt to end the use of M44 cyanide ejectors, commonly known as cyanide bombs, on public lands. KPFA's Joan Walsh reports.
After years of pressure from lawmakers and advocates, the Bureau of Land Management prohibited the use of M44s, or cyanide bombs, on BLM lands in 2023. But just last month, the Trump administration reversed that policy. M44 devices are used to kill coyotes, wolves, and foxes, which supporters say helps protect livestock. But critics say the devices have also killed non-target animals, including cattle, California condors, bears, and even family dogs. The environmental nonprofit Predator Defense issued an action alert today urging Interior Secretary Doug Burgum to stop the return of M44 cyanide devices on the Bureau of Land Management's 245 million acres of public land. The group notes that sodium cyanide, the poison used in the devices, is classified by the Environmental Protection Agency as a Category 1 pesticide, its highest toxicity classification, because of the risks it poses to people and the environment. Brooks Fay, executive director of the Predator Defense and National Wildlife Advocacy Organization, says the government claims animals die within minutes after exposure. But he argues that, contrary to those claims, death from cyanide bombs can be slow and indiscriminate. Fay says it can take up to 8 hours for an animal to die, during which time it may suffer significantly.
The animal goes through tetany with their legs stretching out and they're shaking. They go through convulsions. They self-evacuate. They basically go through repeated seizures until they eventually die from cardiac arrest. Or respiratory arrest.
But supporters of the devices, like Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso, says the device would help the state's sheep industry. In a 2019 assessment of cyanide bombs, it lists its benefits as predator management benefits. The agency concluded that the M44 devices provide benefits to producers of sheep, goats, and cattle, and that in the absence of these products, producers would likely incur higher costs and or more livestock loss. However, the agency wasn't able to quantify the impacts or estimate the number of operations that might be impacted by the loss of available M44 tools, but determined that it was possible the loss of M44 devices would force individual producers out of business. The average total of the sheep industry from 2003 to 2007 alone was estimated to be upwards of $431 million, and cattle estimated around $61 billion. Senator Barrasso said that he wants to ensure that ranchers have access to safe and effective tools to curb the cattle losses from predators. However, California Democrat Jared Huffman has a different take. Huffman says reversing course and bringing cyanide bombs back is, quote, reckless, unnecessary, and unacceptable. In June, Huffman introduced legislation to permanently ban M44 cyanide devices on public lands. The bill is named after Canyon Mansfield, whose life was forever changed at age 14 when he accidentally triggered an M44 device on the Bureau of Land Management near Pocatello, Idaho. The device killed his dog, and Mansfield continues to suffer health effects from exposure to sodium cyanide.
But the golden retriever took a bunch of cyanide to the face. You know, the dog died and the boy was very sick because of that exposure. And that's the kind of thing that happens with these cruel and crude cyanide bombs.
More than 50 family dogs have been documented as killed by M44 cyanide devices since 1990, though the actual number is believed to be significantly higher. Since 1984, there have been 42 documented cases of people accidentally triggering M44 devices and suffering injuries. Among them was a heavy equipment operator in Utah who was permanently disabled after being exposed to sodium cyanide while recreating on Bureau of Land Management land. The exposure ultimately contributed to his death. According to Congressman Jared Huffman, M44 devices kill their intended target only about 53% of the time. Huffman says thousands of non-target animals have been killed by the devices, including bald eagles, golden eagles, gray wolves, black bears, grizzly bears, bobcats, fishers, and family dogs. The North Bay congressman submitted a legislative amendment to the Fiscal Year 2023 Agricultural Appropriations Act that would have restored the ban on M44 devices. However, House Republican leadership did not allow the amendment to come to a vote. For KPFA News, I'm Joan Walsh.
Crowds are gathering this summer for a series of rallies called the Cross-Border Days of Solidarity, pressing for workers' rights as the Trump administration renegotiates the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. Suzanne Potter reports.
The three countries missed the July 1st deadline to extend the USMCA, triggering a series of annual reviews over the next decade. The U.S. and Mexico have already begun two-way negotiations on the trade deal and will meet next on July 20th in Mexico City. The administration plans to speak with Canadian leaders soon as well. Will Wilchko, director of the California Trade Justice Coalition, believes President Donald Trump is trying to escape his past mistakes.
Rather than try to distance himself from the pact he called the greatest trade deal ever and promise would bring jobs foreign into the country, he should be taking its mandated review serious and pushing for the changes needed to actually create jobs, raise wages, and balance trade for working families.
In future negotiations, activists are asking the feds to prioritize people over corporate profits, to reject a race to the bottom that attempts to pit working people in the three countries against one another, and to emphasize shared interests in well-paying jobs, a healthy environment, and sovereignty. Trump says his primary concern with the USMCA involves trade deficits with Mexico and Canada. President Trump has made tariffs the centerpiece of his economic policy, and he says they've already changed the nature of the relationship between the neighboring countries. Wilchko says tariffs can be useful if they're done strategically.
It's not really effective if you implement tariffs and then you withdraw tariffs, then you implement them and then you withdraw them. And it seems to be just some kind of punishment thing or a way to try to leverage political power. It's not how tariffs are supposed to be done.
The Cross-Border Days of Solidarity will continue with rallies in Chico on August 1st and in Sacramento on August 2nd. The USMCA replaced the North American Free Trade Agreement in 2020. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Technology developers, founders, and engineers are at the Moscone Center in San Francisco this week for the AI Engineer World's Fair, one of the largest gatherings in the world dedicated entirely to artificial intelligence agents. Vendors from Munich to the Netherlands to Hawaii are showing off tools that book hotel rooms, screen medical advice, and answer the phone so a human doesn't have to. But behind the demos, attendees are wrestling with larger questions, like what happens to the jobs AI is built to replace. KPFA's Anetta Felix reports from outside the conference.
If you've called a hotel lately, a hospital, or an airline, and found yourself talking to a computer voice instead of a person, you've likely run into what's called an AI agent. It's one of the biggest topics at the AI Engineer World's Fair happening in San Francisco this week, where thousands of software engineers have gathered to build the next generation of these tools. So what exactly is an AI agent? Similar to chatbots like Claude and ChatGPT, AI agents have tools and capabilities that let them accomplish tasks beyond simply making conversation. Evan Mendenhall, founder of a company called Professional AI Agents, explained it in plain terms.
You could talk to ChatGPT and say, hey, I would like you to send an email to my mom that I'm going to be in town later. And then if it's an agent, then it has the tool, the program tool, to be able to take action in software.
Mendenhall says that same idea is already showing up in ways many people may not even notice yet.
Pretty soon they're going to be booking hotels, basically, which is nice, booking flights. There are agents that I learned about at the Twilio Signal event that will notify your family, friends, and company about flight delays. So you can basically just tell the agent what your flight plans are. And you know how every plan's always delayed here and there. Well, now everybody gets notified. You don't even have to think about it.
Christian Boschnik, a senior software engineer from the Netherlands, says the same technology that books a flight is also starting to take over more of his own job.
Last year I was developing 80% of my time still writing my own code, and 20% of the time I was asking agent instead of Stack Overflow. This year I think I haven't even touched the code base manually. I let the agent do the job and I only review it.
Outside the fair, Maximilian Mizonas, founder of Upside AI, pitches a tool aimed at a hospitality problem: hotel and campground front desk that never pick up the phone.
It's a frustrating experience to wait 8 hours for a callback when you just want to have a simple question answered. So we replace their voicemail system with an AI agent. We're not replacing their people, but rather just the voicemail itself, so that if someone calls in, when they call in, they are always able to get what they need and always able to make a reservation over the phone 24/7.
Mizonas also addresses the big concern about AI replacing human jobs. He says since AI will be replacing mundane tasks, he encourages everyone to learn how to build AI agents.
If we can all learn how to build AI agents, then we can all automate away the tasks that don't need humans, and we can focus on the stuff that we really like to do, like being creative and connecting with people and more human tasks.
Rich Samparas, the chief technology officer attending the fair, brings up what's called the AI productivity paradox, which says that as AI tools make tasks faster, efficiency would translate into heavier workloads for employees.
If you enable more labor, better efficiency, instead of reducing the amount of work people do, they will instead just do more work. So you'll just end up with a massive productivity multiplication across any industry that has thinking.
Boschnik thinks the AI boom is not just a trend, but a new milestone in human history.
I think this is the first time in human history where we are actually scaling intelligence, which creates a very different disruption in every industries. If we are getting closer to the base level of human intelligence and we can scale it out, then eventually I think every single job is impacted. And the most that are being replaced are related to anything that's with writing and voice, because these large language models are the best currently with text and text production.
Goldman Sachs research estimates that 300 million jobs globally could be automated by AI, but the same research notes AI is also likely to help create jobs as well. Reporting from San Francisco, I'm Annetta Felix for KPFA Radio.
As the nation prepares to celebrate its 250th birthday this weekend, the legislative branch has momentarily called it quits. House leadership abruptly canceled votes Tuesday and sent lawmakers home early after Speaker Mike Johnson's narrow Republican majority was once again brought to a standstill by members of his own party. This time, the standoff is blocking consideration of the annual defense authorization bill. A group of conservative Republicans is demanding the measure include President Donald Trump's Save America Act, the strict voter ID proposal. Last week, the Senate also ground to a halt amid disagreements tied to Trump's legislative priorities. The emptying Capitol offers another snapshot of the shifting balance of power in Washington as a forceful executive confronts an increasingly fractured Congress. To discuss that and more, KPFA's Lauren Schmidt spoke with the East Bay Congresswoman Latifah Simon.
Sitting here in Washington, D.C., because the Speaker of the House has closed down the House early and has sent members home because they can't do their work. So I'm sitting here continuing to work, but I'm just, again, shocked at how unserious the Republicans are in the House of Representatives, knowing that we have a significant housing bill to pass, knowing that we have appropriations bills that are sitting in front of us, knowing that the Epstein files have not fully been released, knowing that families are hungry and children are being sent home from clinical trials because we're defunding research.
We've been following the War Powers resolution closely in our newsroom, seeing the House and then the Senate pass their versions, then some Republicans trying to take back their votes. I'm wondering if you can brief us on where the War Powers resolution stands and touch on the resolution related to Lebanon, as we do not see consensus among Democrats.
Right. The Lebanon resolution has, you know, it's we still have a ways to go. I'm hoping when we get back from recess, we as again, Republicans are coming on strong, too. They know that we're wasting, $1 billion a day on these forever wars. And so I'm hoping that there'll be some promise there. You have to realize the president of the United States is supposed to come to Congress every single time he wants to move forth on anything that has to do with us using our weapons of war. He has not done that. And we did pass a war powers resolution. But again, we have a president of the United States who doesn't read the law, much less respect the Congress when we're standing up united together. So that's unfortunate as well.
It's been a mixed bag with the Supreme Court as we see this term come to a close with rulings regarding birthright citizenship and blows to TPS and asylum seekers. In our coverage, we noted that the Supreme Court rulings aren't necessarily always the law of the land, as Congress can act and pass laws. So in regards to the rulings, is this something you and your colleagues have been discussing? What in particular are you looking at? And will this be a part of the strategy to pitch to voters to regain control of the House?
Not so much about your last question. I'm not sure what the strategy writ large is. This court has gone to the lowest of the lows. And this week they've gone after transgender children. We are going to remember this decision the way that we remember every ruling that body told a group of children what they could and could not do. We will hold them to account. I mean, secondly, there's a lot of clapping about the Supreme Court affirming birthright citizenship, but that has been so clearly laid out in the 14th Amendment, and yet some of us were clenching our teeth thinking there was going to be an opinion that contorted what was so clearly written in the 14th Amendment. Our answer has to be mobilizing. It has to be organizing. And I believe this next Congress and the people of these United States are sick and tired of these decisions reaching so deeply into literally our own bodies, our own homes, but everything, and I do feel this way, that has been happening on behalf of the Democratic caucus is us preparing for January. We're taking back the House and we're going to slow down this rage to hell that the administration and its court has put on our people.
There has been a rise of candidates who have been backed by the Democratic Socialists of America, winning recent elections against multi-term incumbents, described as establishment Democrats, which has raised concerns not only among Republicans, but fellow Democrats. What is your take, and how does this bode for the future of the Democratic Party?
You know what? I am not a Democratic Socialist. I want to just be very clear. It's an organization that I know of, but that doesn't have a lot of folks that look like me in that organization, right? Or not like, you know, there's not a lot of voices. What I do agree on, however, is a notion that the Americans want something that's not radical. I believe what the members of DSA, those who are winning, those who are running, what they're saying is actually not radical at all. It should be the floor. It's what was written in the 10-point plan in the Black Panther movement, that folks deserve food that won't kill them, deserve health care when they need it, they deserve housing, they deserve education, that we should not be a part of endless wars that kill Black and brown children while we're sending our poorest to go over and do that work. Those are not new traditions. And so, yes, DSA members are winning. And I'm so proud and it's so amazing to see that these ideas, these populist ideas, are being looked at through a new lens because, again, I believe that they're the floor. Now, when we start saying that Black women getting maternal health that they deserve is radical, we have a problem. When we start thinking about the fact in Oakland, California, there's thousands of people who sleep on their streets, housing is not radical. Daycare, that's not $6,000 a month. That's not radical. So poor people have always known these ideas that no matter how hard you work in this country, you don't always get compensated for that level of work. Disabled people have always known no matter the disability, you have to fight for dignity the right not to stay alive. I can go on and on, but I want to make clear that we do ourselves a disservice by thinking there's a new politic coming to the Democratic Party. We have always been here underneath a number of names and umbrellas and mantras. But the idea that liberty and justice and fairness for all, these are the most truest American values. And it's amazing to see young people and young people of color lift those values and win these races. Again, the power lies with the people.
And that was News Director Lauren Schmidt speaking with Latifa Simons. A San Francisco jury has convicted 7 pro-Palestinian protesters of misdemeanor charges for shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge in 2024. Jurors found the group guilty of false imprisonment, obstruction of a thoroughfare, and unlawful...
KPFK? Consider donating property you no longer need. It could be an inherited home, a vacant lot, or a piece of land that's just not part of your plan anymore. Your gift helps fund the programs you rely on and love. Get started today. Visit kpfk.org.